Thanks, Alexandra. Happy to introduce Ahmed El-Hadi. Previous to Princeton, Ahmed was at the did his PhD at the Max Planck for Dynamics and Self-Organization in Göttingen. Works on a range of projects in experimental and theoretical neuroscience, decision-making to forging behavior. Ahmed and I, we met each other some 5 years ago at the Methods in Computational Neuroscience course, summer course in Woods Hole, where we worked on a student project in parameter inference and decision-making models together and started these discussions of how to connect concepts in neuroscience, decision-making with behavior. We also continued these while drinking whiskey and sledding on ice blocks at the Woods Hole golf course. And since then, we've collaborated on multiple theoretical projects and kept in touch. So I'm very excited that Ahmed is now joining us here and looking forward to continuing these connections and looking forward to your talk today.
Thank you. Okay, I will just stand here to change the slides. Thank you, everyone, for coming here at this. You know, as the cases are increasing, so it's quite an effort to be here in person. So today, I'm going to give you an overview of the work that I have been doing. I might leave out some details, but I'm around, so you can grab me and we can discuss things at length. So I was trained as a systems neuroscientist, and a systems neuroscientist would love to look at this behavior, at a behavior happening by, for example, here a rodent, and understand what's happening in the brain of this rodent in order to produce this behavior, how brain areas are interacting in order to give rise to behavior. And the behavior that I have been working on in the last few years is what is called evidence accumulation. So evidence accumulation is a form of integration that how one accumulates evidence for or against different decisions and use this accumulated evidence in order to reach a choice. And have been postulated to be a core computation underlying many of the decisions in our everyday life, from sensory decisions, economic decisions, value decisions, and others. So it's a very core cognitive process and can account for many of these decisions we see. So how can we explain it in simple terms? So let's look at these bounds as if there are the choices that I have. I have two choices. And the choices are right or left. Do I go right or I orient left? And I begin with zero here. This is my initial state. And then I begin to accumulate evidence till I reach one of the bounds. And if the features that make me go to right will add to this accumulator, A, or the features that makes me lean to left will subtract from A. And we call this the decision border. So you can see here there is this curve is rising slowly because we can abstract this as a way that there is a hard decision which is quite slow. So the psychological observation, the hard decisions are usually slow, and that the easy decisions are fast, so this rise to the bound is much faster. This type of models have been studied for a very long time in the behavioral literature. So as systems neuroscientist, you would like to understand this process in a simplified system where you can probe not only the behavioral mechanisms but also the neural mechanisms. And the system of choice for many people are rodents, and in this case, I will talk about rats. And how to do this type of evidence accumulation behavior of rats? You put the rats in a training chamber, in an operant chamber that have three pokes, and then you play sounds from both sides. And the question is, auditory clicks, and the question is which sides, left versus right, played the greater number of clicks? This type of behavior have been very well studied in systems neuroscience, and the beauty of it is that you can basically construct, here we are looking at how the probability density of this accumulator value that I have shown in the previous slide evolve over time till you reach a decision. Not only it is observed behaviorally, but people have recorded from the brain and have seen that there are firing rates in some brain areas that follow the evolution of this probability density. People have also observed that there are brain areas where, that are tuned to this accumulator value and to this choice. So for systems neuroscientists, it became to become an ideal system because I can have a behavior that I can model and also find neural processes that mimic this behavioral dynamics. And when I came to the lab in Princeton, I wanted to add a bit of complexity into this task. And I established what is called the dynamic clicks task. And the dynamic clicks task is exactly the same task I said we play auditory clicks, but instead of one stream, there are two streams, meaning that in the middle of the trial, the environment changed into another stream. So we have two states. A state, for example, here you have more clicks on the right and less on the left, and here more on the left and more on the right. So this is a pretty challenging task. And for this, the animal don't need only to accumulate evidence, but also have to throw away evidence in order to decide which state it is in. And the animal at the end is rewarded by guessing right the last state at which the trial have ended. So this adds a component of, as I said, discounting into the behavior. And how do we quantify this? We quantify this using something called the psychophysical reverse correlation. And this simply tells me whether the agent doing the task is impulsive, meaning weighing the initial evidence in a trial more than the ones at the end of the trial. Lossless mean like weighing all the evidence equally all over the trial, when the evidence here are the auditory clicks that the animal is listening to. Leaky means that the animal cares more about the auditory clicks at the end of the trial. And in order to be able to solve this task, the animal have to throw away previous evidence that is not informative about the state they are in. And basically, you can find this in our data. So this is the data from a single rat, and this is here the data from 14 rats. And to fit this curve, we have a huge amount of trials. This is here, it's a quarter of a million trials. Also, we can use the same drift diffusion modeling approach in order to understand this behavior. And intuitively here, the parameters of the model is that it's a noisy process, so I have my initial state, which is quite noisy, and then I have some sensory noise, and then when I receive a click of sound, my decision variable evolves towards a bound, but then it decays with some lambda. Lambda here is the most important parameter because it tells me how fast I am discarding evidence. And the inverse of this lambda is the integration time scale. So here, just to give you some intuition, in the static task where there is no state changes, this lambda is almost zero. There is some distribution, but it's almost zero because the animal should not discount any auditory evidence. But here, in this dynamic task, the animal should discount evidence, and we find that we can basically accurately predict the value of this model lambda. So that's quite neat because here we have a handle over the integration time scale of the animal. So if we change how fast this state are changing in the environment, we are able to control the integration time scale of the animal. And we can basically do this by switching the environmental volatility. So we put the animal in this first task where the states are changing, so we get this kind of curves. The animal is discounting evidence, but and then we put it in the next session into this static task where there is nothing is changing. It's able to adapt very quickly its integration time scale, which for people studying integration circuits, it's a very neat tool in order to vary this integration time scale. So what kind of options having this type of task opens for us? For example, one can go in and do electrophysiological recording. I will not go so much into the details here, but here I'm showing recordings from a brain area called the frontal orbital fields. And we can find here these two colors basically signify the two states that are switching. We have neurons that are able to differentiate between the two states. And moreover, we have areas that encode, cells that encode the state switches that are happening. So you get this firing rate in changes with the state change. And this is what we call changes of mind. So why systems neuroscientists do this? Because at the end of the day, you would like to construct a circuit like this, to have a decision-making circuit and ask how the sensory information you are receiving from the world is receiving is transformed into a motor command. And in the area of evidence accumulations, there have been different areas proposed. And I have used one imaging technique called functional ultrasound in this context, but I will not go into it today. And the idea is to begin to fill these gaps in order to construct this full circuit. So let's then zoom out and ask some conceptual questions. Why do people do animal training? Because they think they are controlling the behavior of the animal. So when I do the train them, I convince myself that the rat is actually accumulating this evidence over time, and I have a self-consistent analytical technique that can show to me that they are accumulating or integrating. You have multiple repeatable trials that allows you to do this modeling approaches, but then also make the neural investigation easier. So you can relate some neural dynamics to some task variables. But always the devil is in the details. So what I haven't said is, so this task take 3 to 6 months in order to train the rat on. The rats are put on water restriction in order to motivate them, which is quite an issue because you will ask, okay, what is the effect of thirst on the neural dynamics that you are observing? And the question that not many are asking, are we just training the behavior or also the brain? Because the brain is quite plastic and you are giving it a stimulation or a stimulus and shaping over this very long time, so what's happening? The next question is the state dependence. What is the physiological state of the animal with every session? Is it the same or not? And then also, I think a lot of time it's forgotten that the animal has a body. How is it orienting? How it is doing the task? And a lot of times when you hear people talking about the trained tasks as if there is a brain only doing the task inside this behavior box and there is nobody. And this is the brain in a vat. Moreover, for something personal for me, this type of trained behavior will not help me understand my favorite friends in New York City. So I lived in New York before coming here, and this is a video in Union Square where this rat is carrying a piece of pizza down the stairs. And then, this guy ran away, okay, then look back, okay, asking, should I go back, take this pizza, or there might be a more delicious pizza somewhere else. So this type of decisions, we are making it almost on a daily life, not only, you know, not only this rat, but all animals. So as Jacob said, in Woods Hole, I met this guy, Jacob Davidson, and with the help of some good whiskey, we were able to think through about how can we formalize foraging as an evidence accumulation problem. So I'm going to introduce foraging, but I think for this audience is, you know, a solved problem. But why I find foraging a very exciting problem, because animals have to self-sustain through acquiring energy and search for food. It's a universal behavior, so all animals do, from sea elegans, Drosophila, rodents, primates, and including ourselves. It happens over multiple spatial temporal scales, so I can study it in a lab. For example, a rat will forage, but then also in the field. It is sensitive to environmental structures, so changing the environment will change the foraging strategy of the animal. And more importantly, was for me and Jacob also, is that it has a history in behavioral ecology to be quantitative. And recently there have been a surge in neuroscience to study foraging, and because it is the closest naturalistic decision-making that we, problem that we can study. Before I delve into more details, I will tell you more about my the way I approach the problem of foraging, so what I call the integrative approach. Here there are bats, but they can be other animals. This was just a picture from a grant that I wrote. But usually, animals forage in groups. They have their own private information and social information, and they search for food. So how can one understand, what are the different levels at which one can understand the problem? So first, on the very long time scale, on the scale of ecological fitness. So the environmental adaptability, how does it improve my mate choice and reproductive success? The second thing is on the behavioral algorithmic level, how do my foraging strategies are shaped by the structure of the environment, the distribution of resources, and the social cues I'm getting from other conspecifics in the environment. And the next level is how these behavioral algorithms are implemented on neural and biochemical circuitry, either in the brain or the body. And by integrative approach, I mean being able to relate the three levels together. And today, I'm going to focus on the behavioral algorithms that I have invested a lot of time in the last few years. And I recall discussions with Jacob about which foraging problem we should tackle. Is the patch leaving problem was the canonical foraging behavior that we decided to tackle. And patch foraging behavior means that if an animal enters into an environment and there are patches of food, it enters into a patch, consume some food, and then go to the next patch. And the question is, how do you decide to leave and when do you leave? And the behavioral observables you have in this behavior are the patch residence time, how much time you spend in a patch, the travel time, the time one travels between patches, and the food intake, how much food you are consuming in a patch. Historically, there have been a classical approach to optimal foraging theory called marginal value theorem. And marginal value theorem first assumes that the resources are in patches in the environment, and this states that the animal will leave the patch when its current patch intake is equal to the average environmental intake. And maybe some of you have seen this curves when you plot the time foraging in patch with the cumulative resource intake, you get this kind of curve and you get the optimal time in a patch when your own current patch intake is equal to the average environmental intake. And it's a quite old proposal from 1976 by Chernov. But again, the devil is in the assumptions. So there are very strong assumptions underlying the marginal value theorem is that the animal knows the distribution of food in the environment, that the food is arriving continuously, and that the environment is not changing. So what do we do with the marginal value theorem? We use marginal value theorem as a guiding principle and measure for comparison, whether an animal behaves suboptimal to marginal value theorem and how it deviates from it. So the two main mechanistic questions, the other thing before I forget is that the marginal value theorem doesn't tell us how does the animal decide to leave the patch. So the mechanistic questions we decided to tackle is how does the animal implement a marginal value theorem or marginal value theorem-like rule? That's the first question. And the second question is how to account for uncertainty or stochasticity in the foraging process. And we used two modeling approaches that I'm going to go through today. The first is a heuristic accumulator model, like the one I presented in the first part of the talk, this evidence accumulation model, and to account for the uncertainty in the environment, we use the Bayesian approach. So for the first one, the heuristic accumulator model is what we call the foraging drift diffusion model. So for this, I imagine myself being the rat. I enter into a patch that have food, and then I have in my brain a decision variable that is evolving, and I'm consuming food, and this food is the evidence. I take food, and then the decision variable begin to evolve toward a bound, and then I leave the patch. So what is happening here is that the animal is tracking the reward encountered in the patch. And you can quantify this, the patch, by looking at its initial food density, its patch size, and the size of the food chunk inside. And this is the travel time parameter. So how can we write this in equations? So for while the animal is basically inside the patch consuming food, it has to do two things. First, it has to track the change in the environment, in the energy level, the available energy in the environment, and this is accounted for in this equation. And the next thing, it has to track how much food it is consuming inside the patch in a noisy process. So let's slowly go through this equation. Here you have your decision variable, and here this is the time scale for update of this decision variable, and here I have my drift parameter. And here in this RT, this is the rate of food intake with some Wiener noise term. And intuitively, you will leave the patch when this X, this decision variable, reads a threshold eta. And if one simulates these equations, we are able to get this evolution of the probability density of our decision variables as per a food arrival. These are the food evidence that you consume some food and then you are kicked, you consume some food, you are kicked, and so on, till you leave the patch, which is here at this boundary. So, okay, how do we get different strategies? Because the animal can be inside the patch, it can count the food chunks, it can estimate the density of the food. So, saving you a lot of derivations, if you trust me, we have this decision threshold equation where the decision threshold depends on multiple parameters. First, on the patch size, on the drift rate, on the average energy in the environment, on the initial density of food in patch, and some constant cost. And the two important parameters here are the threshold and the drift rate. By varying both of them, we are able to get different decision strategies. One decision strategy, we call it the decremental strategy, and one we call it the increment-decrement strategy. So what do I mean by these terms? So let's look at an example. An increment-decrement strategy meaning that if the animal enters into the patch, when it finds the food, it makes it more likely to stay in the patch. And the decrement strategy, which might sound weird at first, is finding food makes the animal more likely to leave the patch. Because, okay, one would think, if I find food, I should stay more. So when does one of these strategies are optimal in some environment, and this is optimal in another environment? So the increment-decrement strategy is optimal when the amount of food per patch is unknown. So if the animal doesn't know the amount of food in a patch, it will do this increment-decrement strategy. And you can quantify this in an experiment by plotting the patch residence time by the patch food density. And if you get this increase in the patch residence time with the patch food density, then the animal most probably is adopting this type of increment-decrement strategy. So the other strategy, this decremental or counting strategy, is when is it optimal? It is optimal if the animal knows exactly how much food there is inside the patch. So because the animal knows how much food there is in the patch, when I take one, let's say there is five, I take one, okay, I'm becoming more and more likely to leave the patch. Okay, so here I told stories about how an animal will be able to do it. It is mostly an assumed decision heuristics, because you assume that the animal is doing an accumulation process and there is some decision threshold that is crossed. We're able to get a variety of strategies depending on the threshold and the drift rate. But the questions that begin to bug us is, can we derive these foraging decision strategies normatively? And to do this, we jumped into doing a Bayesian approach to patch foraging. So what is a Bayesian approach? It's a statistical learning approach, meaning that you, an agent accumulates a statistical evidence over time about the patch or the environment quality. And it has a history in behavioral ecology, people trying to ask the question, are animals capable of Bayesian updating? Do they act like Bayesians? And the drawbacks of the models that were in the literature from our view was that they were quite restricted and quite abstract also. And for something very important for me is that they were very hard to relate to motion data, body posture, and neural dynamics. So what kind of a statistical inference problem is the animal solving while foraging in the context of patch foraging? So let's split this into two problems. If an animal enters into a very new environment, its first search for its habitat. So it has to search for the habitat that have the most richest resources. And once it is in a habitat, it begins to exploit patches. Okay, so there is two levels here that we are acting on. This habitat choice, one can approximate it by the case of a non-depleting patch, and the patch exploitation problem is in the case of depletion. But what do I mean by a statistical inference problem? So what is the recipe here? The animal, let's say the animal enters into the environment and it has a prior probability onto how rich this environment is. It gets into a patch and begins to encounter food, and then it updates its belief about this patch, and it constructs what we call an observer belief. In equations, this is written in terms of the famous Bayes rule, and it depends on three main parameters: the number of food encounters at time t, at the prior distribution of yield rates, which is signify how rich the patch is, and rho, which is the impact of each chunk of food on the update of the yield rate. And if one simulates this, the maximum likelihood estimation of this reward rate will approximate the true reward rate of the patch over long time. So let's go into the separate problems deeper. So in the habitat selection problem, let's say I have three habitats that have different richness, and you ask the question, what is the strategy of the animal in order to find the habitat that have the richest resources or the highest percentage of rich resources? So the animal will keep searching till it remains in the highest the habitat that has the highest resources. So what the animal is trying to optimize here is to minimize the time to find the high quality patch. And the more I have more rich resources in this habitat, the more it will be obvious, so that it will strongly shape the animal behavior. So this is what we think might be intuitively happen. But is it happening formally, quantitatively, using our model? So today, I will only talk about binary cases, but we have treated the ternary, quaternary, 5N. cases, but for simplicity, I will just talk about here the binary choice. So if the animal have to choose between two environments, one that have high reward rate and one have a low reward rate. So you can write the evolution of the belief of the animal using the stochastic differential equation that have two terms, one that account for the food encounter and one that account for the lack of food. So let's see more graphically how that belief of the animal evolve over time. So let's say I begin in the highly rewarding patch, I go to the low rewarding patch, and I keep going back and forth in a sequence till I ultimately leave the low yielding patch and stay in the high yielding patch. And this is what we call a sequence of stay and go decisions. And what you try to minimize here is really through this sequence of stay-go decisions, you minimize the time to reach and remain in the high yielding patch. And using our model, basically, we can compute exactly this time to arrive in the high-yielding patch that have two terms. It looks ugly, but if we understand simply what it means, it will become easier to understand. It's first, this first term here tells me how many visits I need to do to the high-yielding patches in order to know that this is a high-yielding patch. And the next term, it tells me if I begin in the low-yielding patch, how long would it pass in order for me to just leave it ultimately? So let's look at the parameter dependencies of this model. So in the case of the habitat choice, we said that the animal is trying to minimize the arrival time. So let's play around with the parameters. If we keep the low reward rate, the environment with the low yield rate constant, and we change the reward rate of the high yielding rate. So the more it increases, this arrival time decreases. Sounds intuitive, but we can also get this quantitatively and accurately. If we keep the ratio between the reward rate of the high yielding patches to the low yielding patches constant, which we call discriminability, this ratio between them discriminability constant, and change the proportion of the high yielding patch, the more we have a proportion of high yielding patches in the environment, we are able to reduce and minimize this arrival time. So the higher the high reward rate in the environment, I am able to minimize this arrival time, and the more high yielding patches I have in the environment, this arrival time is also minimized. Another term that is even not observable from the experiment, but we are able to compute, which is the optimal threshold at which the agent is going to leave from the low yielding rate in order to stay in the high yielding rate. And this depends very strongly on the high yielding rate. So just to recapitulate this part is, in the habitat selection problem, we can treat these habitats as non-depleting patches. The animal will search between them and will be individually computing a log likelihood ratio between the high and low patches till it reaches a threshold and ultimately leave the habitat with the low resources and stay with the one with the high resources. Most important thing is this is a very strong deviation from the typical assumptions of the marginal value theorem, because the marginal value theorem doesn't really account for time or minimizing time. And that the discriminability of the high patches, the existence of highly or salient resources in the environment, really strongly shapes the time and the strategy to find the high patches. So next, I will go into the patch exploitation problem, which is if there is depleting environment. It means that the resources here are depleting in each of these patches. And okay, we can try to think, what would the animal do? The animal will deplete a bit from one patch and then depart, deplete and depart, and ultimately will stay more time in the patch that have the highest reward rate. But depending on your assumption, maybe, you know, if the animal knows already the reward rate in the environment, it will follow, we can assume that it will follow the assumptions, the marginal value theorem. But if there is uncertainty, one would predict that it will deviate from the marginal value theorem predictions. So let's delve into this problem more. Here, if the animal is not, in order to have to optimally solve this problem, you will not minimize the time to arrive in the high yielding patches, but you will try to optimize for the long term reward rate. So this is a different optimization problem in this case. And one can imagine two scenarios. What we call first the depletion dominated regime is that the animal already knows the yield rate of the patch it's entering, and the leaving decisions will only be based on the depletion. And this case totally recapitulates the marginal value theorem. The second case, which is more realistic, is that the animal enters into the patch and not know the type of the patch, meaning its reward rate. So the leaving decisions have to consider the uncertainty in the estimate of this of the current yield rate of the patch. How can we look at this quantitatively? In our model, when you have no uncertainty at all, we are able basically to recapitulate the marginal value theorem, which tells you that the reward you leave the patch when the reward rate of the environment it is equal to your current reward rate. But what if we have uncertainty in the environment? So if you have uncertainty in the environment, the animals will tend to stay longer in the low-yielding patches and will leave sooner from the high-yielding patches, thus deviating from the marginal value theorem here. And this effect will depend on how much food do I have in the patch. The more I have food chunks in the patch, the less of this effect I will see. So here, the predictions of our model, the hypothesis we are putting forward is that in the case of this depleting environments, what the animal is doing is not like in the case of the habitat choice, computing some log likelihood ratio of the high versus the low. It is doing a maximum likelihood estimation over the arrival rate of the food till it reaches a threshold. At this threshold, it will know the underlying reward rate of the patches. And most importantly, that if we have uncertainty in the environment, the foragers will tend to under-harvest the high-yielding patches and over-harvest the low-yielding patches. So concluding this part, just to again go back conceptually away from the details, is that we are able to develop a very flexible framework to model normative decision evidence accumulation in patch leaving decisions. And here I presented these two problems of the habitat selection and the patch exploitation. And we have shown not only in binary, but in up to n patches. We have shown that also that the uncertainty shapes the strategies in depleting environments, so the animal can either over-harvest or under-harvest depending on the type of patch it is in. One part I have not shown is a learning model that hopefully should be out soon. How does the animal learn the underlying structure of reward in the environment? And to give you the kick here is that we are able to show that learning the food arrival rates is quicker in the depleting environment than the non-depleting environment. So how do we make this model even more flexible? So in a recent collaboration with the group of Zach Kilpatrick in Boulder, Colorado, we are extending this evidence accumulation model to include social information transfer. So you add to the drift diffusion model social information terms that couple your agents. So if you have two agents that are transferring information between each other, and what the information that are transferring in this drift diffusion case is information about either they are coupled diffusively, meaning that they help each other as if they help each other to estimate the reward rate in the patch they are in, or a pulsatile coupling, which is another mechanism that one can imagine is when both agents are doing their own accumulation process, but then when one of them leave, it gives a pulse to the other and tell you, okay, to leave now. One can also think to include in this type of models the hierarchy. So you can have a heterogeneous agent that have different ways by which they are exploiting the patches. So you can see that we are even making the model ever and ever more flexible to account even for large-scale social foraging. So to go back to my initial endeavor and the title of my talk, From Training to Natural Behavior, and what we are trying to do is really push a bit the boundary over what is possible in terms of quantitative behavior that have in mind at the end in the future to do neuroscientific studies. Is there have been A lot of tradition doing a trial-based structure behaviors that are usually happen over short time scale, and the neuroscience parts usually people measure from single or few brain areas, which is it's evolving quite fast now to brain-wide recordings. So one can imagine that pushing the boundary on this would be to be able to study continuous behaviors that happen continuously in freely moving animal over extended time scales. And that's what brought me to Constance Milley, is that on how do we experiment with these models on large scale and change many conditions? Because you can imagine the models that I presented have many parameters. So you are usually tied between this either highly controlled lab experiments or in the field. So what is what can happen here in the middle? And here in the middle, the imaging hangar can just outside, which I usually imagine it as some kind of a mesoscale level of experiments. So that's what I plan to do, to have rats running around and do all kind of patch foraging on what I called large-scale naturalistic experiments. So what's after? What the future looks like in my eyes is that you don't only have, you have the animals doing the patch foraging behavior in this large scale environment, and you have your quantitative behavioral models. You are able to track the animals, to look at their navigation strategies, their posture, while you are recording from their brain, and there are the non-invasive technologies are developing more and more, so I'm hoping one is able to do this. And while at Princeton, I played a bit with making rats do some basic patch foraging. I built an arena that have a rat running around. So before I play the video, what I have here is a custom-made arena from plastic, and then you have this fake grass that is screwed into the surface here, and there is some nice food that they like here, the rats, and I made the rat just run around. Very cute. You know. So smells, they are very olfactory. He's smelling, okay. He cannot see the food inside. Oh, oops. Food. Food time. And yeah, they are eating. He's eating and then we'll go around and eat from other places. This is just like to give you an idea of what type of experiments I will do. What I will do will be on a much more systematic and larger scale, but this is like the basic behaviors. You don't need to train the rat to do this, they do it spontaneously. They just search and go around. Okay. So at the end of my talk, I would like to acknowledge many of the people that I have worked with, most prominently in Princeton, Carlos Brody and Asif Gazenfar, in CU Boulder, Zach Kilpatrick, and my collaborator at Janilia Farm Research Campus, Emily Dennis, and across in Tübingen, Peter Diane, who have invested interest in foraging models. And here, this wouldn't have been possible without Ian Cousins being on board with all type of crazy experiments I would like to do. And of course, Jacob Davidson, who have been my collaborator since 2016, and it will continue while I'm here, along with many others at the MPI for Animal Behavior and the UniConstant. And more importantly, I would have not been standing here without the excellent administrative support that I got in terms of visas and other things. Michael Menda, Alexandra, Matthias, Daniela, Elizabeth, Felicia, and Katinka, thank you. And thank you for the thanks for the funding sources. Thank you. Okay, good.
So, thank you, Ahmed. Maybe for the questions, we could do it the way that we can just pass around the microphone, and the people who are on the Zoom call, they can just type the cue into the chat, and then we can try if we can make the sound work. They can actually ask the question. If it doesn't work, I can read okay. their questions aloud. So,
good.
Thanks for the Great talk. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. So in your experimental environment and in your model as well, I think like energy intake per food encounter is constant, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I'm wondering if what happened if the energy intake would be also varied. Like for example, some food pouches have like some mediocre food, but in a high density or high frequency, but whereas other pouches might have really nutrient rich food, but in very like low frequency, for example. Do you have any like?
Yeah, we have been thinking about this question also with Ian, along with a group in Australia. I forgot their name. That there is this concept of nutritional geometry. So you try to account for the amount of carbohydrate and proteins you have in the environment. We have been thinking on the line how to incorporate this as a model to change the cost, the metabolic cost that we have. So, and then we can compute what the strategies that the animal will do.
I see. So do you have any kind of particular prediction about like, is your model constantly biased toward, for example, like a more high frequency but mediocre patch, or
it's more biased to high patch with some fixed quality.
Interesting. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for the great talk. So I was wondering if you would also integrate internal state changes in your model, like if the animal is hungry, would it change the threshold when to leave the pet?
Yes. You got into the right. It will affect the decision threshold. So we can also integrate it related to this nutritional geometry, just said. We can incorporate satiation level, like have it more binary, like satiated or non-satiated. I think this is the easiest first case that we can do. And it will affect the threshold, meaning that you can leave earlier than you are predicted, for example, if you are satiated or more satiated.
And you also think that might play a role in the social context? That like starved animals?
Yes, of course.
Sort of the behavior of non-starved.
Yeah, we are being recorded. So starved animals, water restricted rats are aggressive. One thing with rats is that they can really get into very bad fights. And my prediction is that this is driven by this restriction if they are not satiated, so there is more competition over the resources. For me, the interesting regime will be if they are satiated, we can get into a cooperative regime where we get the social information transfer enhanced, which have been studied before.
Hi, Chiyu. If you hear me, you can either ask the question yourself or I can read it out for you. Maybe I'll just read it out. I would like to know more about how the increment and decrement strategy evolve over time. Does it assume that animals spending more time in a patch would be more likely to know about the resources in the patch, which causes them to leave the path based on the decremental strategy?
In the increment-decrement strategy, the more you spend, the more you know about the patch. But the decrement strategy, the animal enters knowing what is the type of the patch, like how much food you have inside.
Thank you. So I hope that answers Chiu's question. If not, feel free to type in again. Any other questions?
What's the relationship between the length scales of the patch and the distance to the next patch? Is there any relationship between those?
So in these models, we considered constant travel time. We haven't played with this parameter. So building on this, I'm hoping to have a student or something working on the spatial aspect. So how do we, if we structure the environment, how does the strategies work? But here space is not considered. But hopefully, next year, hopefully ask me.
Anna? just following on the length scales and the social interaction. So if the patches are not that far away, then individuals can get social information between patches and personal information only within a patch, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, because you demand, I don't know the rats. So I don't know to what degree they will actually avoid patches that are habitated because there will be less food, or whether they would actually, but it indicates there is a patch. So I guess it's all about.
Yeah, so this again goes to back to Catherine's question about the situation. So I feel if there is someone eating in the patch, they might take this as indication that there is reward. So they might go and not avoid it. So that's a totally empirical question.
Okay, but the idea is that they would be able to detect patches using social information.
Yes, because this the grass, the artificial grass, I want to put is really high, so they cannot see the food. Always there is the olfaction, but that's a whole other dimension.
This is a question by Advait from the Zoom community. Did you want to ask yourself, or shall I just read it out?
I can. Can you hear me?
Yeah, wonderful.
Yes.
No, I was just wondering that now you have the hangar, are you also planning to simulate predator presence or something like that to see how strategy changes? Because in natural settings, animals are usually foraging under some kind of predation risk.
Mm-hmm. To get the permission to have an animal to eat a rat inside an experiment is not something I will foresee. But you can have the rats as predators to eat the locusts, for example. So the rats eat insects, they can eat locusts. But this will be a more complicated situation because you will have two moving objects and then you will be running after them. It will be quite messy. So beginning by the simpler one, but the predation, go back to the predation risk. The rats act, in my opinion, instinctually as if they are under risk of predation. That's why we will not have a very big open space, because if there is a big open space, they think there is a predator waiting for me there. They don't have to see the predator to really, because if you also, someone is familiar with the looming stimuli experiment that Markus Meister have done, is you just have like light coming in and then the mouse or also the rat will run away. That's why the arena will have a lot of features so that they feel safe. The rats by instinct are afraid animals. But I don't know why people are afraid of them. But
thanks. Ian has a question. Ian, did you just
Hi. Yeah. It was more of a. I mean, you said it yourself, Ahmed. What we can do in the imaging hangars, we can have closed loop, real-time feedback. So we could, for example, if you wanted to, make some parts of the environment more, you know, suddenly appear more risky than others, or you could manipulate risk in a subtle way that wouldn't be. Could be quite interesting, but as you said, maybe that's for down the line.
Yes. You can structure, you can have some of the simplest way to do it is to hide part of the arena and in the middle of the experiment reveal this part to be more risky. That's like intermediate stage, but.
We could show loom, and we do this with other animals. We could show loom stimulus, or we could show, you know, sort of just changing local light conditions should make them wonder what's changed. Is that a cloud moving over the sun, or is that a predator? You know, so you can create this sort of ambiguous environments if you wanted to.
Yeah. Thanks, Ian.
Any more questions in the room or in the chat? If not, thank you so much, Ahmed, for this really inspiring talk.
Thank you.
Great job. And thank you all for coming today. And feel free to stay around and talk to Ahmed if you like. And or you can also move upstairs to the cluster floor eating area and sit there and have a chat. For those who haven't registered today for on-site attendance,